Europe is experiencing the largest wave of refugees since World War II and is desperate to find a long-term solution. Join America Abroad for a town hall discussion linking New York to Berlin on iTunes and PRI.org/AmericaAbroad.
The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
A Hero in Beirut, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and for Marco Werman, Beirut is mourning the victims of twin suicide bombings. One of those victims actually helped keep many others alive.
There are many, many families, hundreds of families probably, that owe their completeness to his sacrifice yesterday.
His story is coming up. Plus, a man follows through on his brother's dream to help Syrian refugees in Turkey.
And this is helping me explore everything that I've ever wanted to explore, do the work that earns me personal salvation. That's where I'll see my brother and the prophets, all of them.
And a Muslim woman in Australia gets tired of the Twitter hate.
As I was sitting there, I thought, why don't I donate $1 to charity for every hate-filled tweet I get?
How much so far? Find out ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman. This is The World. How do you measure success or failure in the war against ISIS, the so-called Islamic State? It's a hard question to answer, but it seems we're seeing a little bit of both, success and failure, in just the past 24 hours. Success in northern Iraq, where Kurdish forces have pushed ISIS militants out of a strategic town with U.S. help. We'll have an update from Sinjar in just a moment. First, though, an apparent setback. ISIS has claimed responsibility for the twin suicide bombings yesterday in Lebanon. The blasts ripped through a residential and commercial area of southern Beirut during the evening rush hour. More than 40 people were killed. At least 200 others were injured. Blogger and physician Eli Faras lives in Beirut, where he works in a hospital. I spoke to him today about the bombings. He credits a man named Adel Termos with saving countless lives at the scene of the explosions.
He was with his daughter in that area, in that particular street, which is a very populated street. When the first attack happened, it's possibly a human nature thing that whenever something out of the ordinary happens, people gather around to see what's taking place. So naturally, they were gathering around to see what took place in the first suicide bomb. The second suicide bomber was approaching to detonate himself, and Adel Termos saw him, and he approached him. He tackled him to the ground, causing the second suicide bomber to detonate himself, killing Adel instantly, but saving hundreds of lives, possibly. And Adel's daughter also died in the process. There are many, many families, hundreds of families probably, that owe their completeness to his sacrifice yesterday.
In this case, are people talking about Adel Termos?
The thing about the attacks this time is that there's a national sense of unity behind it. And Adel Termos, yeah, he's a pronounced figure today. I've seen him all over my Facebook timeline. People were discussing him at my workplace today. He's become famous in the country today for his sacrifice and for what he did.
Are you saying that in the past, when there were these kind of attacks and people died, that Lebanese would interpret it through the lens of Lebanese politics, but this time everybody's feeling like a victim?
Yeah, exactly. The street is still divided according to political and sectarian lines. But this time around, the sense is that these are people, period. It's not like before that these are people who belong probably to Hezbollah or who are affiliated in a way or another with Hezbollah, therefore their death has to be interpreted in a certain political context. You know, people are now tired and they're sick of this whole political background that politicians or analysts give for everything. They're looking at these explosions and saying that these are just people like us, and they're dead because of something they had absolutely no role in.
What do you know about the other victims?
They're school teachers, they're lawyers. There are a couple who worked at the American University Medical Center, American University of Beirut Medical Center. One of them was a nurse. The other was a professor at the Faculty of Agriculture and Food Sciences. There's even an American from Dearborn, Michigan, who died yesterday. She's originally Lebanese, but she was there in that, in the attacks. There are people from all kinds of kinds. There are Syrians, there are Palestinians, there are many nationalities.
Are these 45 victims of this latest attack martyrs in your mind?
They're not people who chose to die for a cause. They're not people who went to that street knowing that they would die by explosion, or they're not dying for any cause. They were people who were shopping, who were taking out their kids to prayer, who were just you know, just walking up and down a street next to where they lived, and they died because of some demented, twisted politics that they had no role in. Calling them martyrs is a sort of a Lebanese way to not only dehumanize them, it's to sort of make ourselves feel better that, yeah, it's okay. I mean, they died, but now they're martyrs, which means they're in heaven and they're in a better place. But the fact of the matter is that it's just sort of a label to make ourselves feel better and to make maybe their families feel better, because the label of victim means that there's a sort of accountability in the process. Whereas as martyrdom means that we can actually get away with it without someone being held accountable and without pretending that we have to actually get to the bottom of it at a certain point in time.
You've written in your blog that Aldel's story holds a striking resemblance to another attack that happened in Tripoli, Lebanon.
Another person who called Abu Ali Isa, who also tackled a suicide bomber back in January of this same year when Tripoli was attacked by two suicide bombers as well. It's an eerily similar scenario. And Abu Ali Isa, who was a father of seven, saw the second suicide bomber approaching, and he ran at him, tackled him, causing him to detonate himself as well. And he saved hundreds of lives also at the time by doing almost the same thing that Adel did yesterday. They're both from different sects, different regions, different cities, but the scenario is similar. The stories keep repeating themselves, and you have families that are getting shattered, and you have a country that's being bruised and maimed. So the question is, when will the cycle end, and when will I not need to write about heroes emerging by tackling suicide bombers and people who are dying just for being at a cafe or walking up a street or shopping with their children?
Lebanese blogger Eli Fattas is a doctor in Beirut. Thank you for speaking to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
ISIS may have carried out those bombings in Beirut, as it claims, but the extremist group appears to have suffered a serious setback at about the same time. It's lost control of the strategic town of Sinjar in northern Iraq. An alliance of Kurdish soldiers and other groups, backed up by U.S. air power, pushed the militants out. Ben Kessling of the Wall Street Journal is in Sinjar. He also happens to be a former Marine infantry officer. I asked him earlier what liberated Sinjar looks like.
Well, the very odd thing about liberated Sinjar is there isn't much to liberate. The Islamic State essentially chased away or enslaved and took away the civilians who were living there. And the mayor of the Sinjar district told me, he said, look, we weren't preparing for a humanitarian crisis, and we weren't preparing for any refugees because we figured there weren't any. And when you go into Sinjar city proper, it's almost like a ghost town. Things are just destroyed by airstrikes, by fighting. There's rubble in the streets. And the only people in the town when I was there were Yazidi fighters who had taken back their hometown.
Any sign of the Yazidi women and girls that were enslaved by ISIS after the town fell last year?
The only women that you see in the area now are fighters with the PKK, which is a Kurdish fighting group, and they have female fighters. And there wasn't really any sign of any civilians, but some of the men we talked to spoke of trying to keep track of and keep in touch any way they could with family members who had been moved elsewhere, and some had been able to keep in touch and track people who had gone to places like Mosul, taken there by Islamic State.
How much of a success is the liberation of Sinjar?
Well, that remains to be seen. When we're talking to people on the ground, whether it be Kurdish officials or people taking place in the fight or other civilians, they said, well, this is fantastic, but if Kurdish forces and coalition forces don't go on to ensure that places like Mosul fall and are taken back from Islamic State, then the victory in Sinjar, a lot of people worry that it's going to be futile.
What happened to the ISIS fighters? Did they flee? Are they hiding out? What do we know about that?
So the last we heard about the possible ISIS fighters were Yazidi Peshmerga commanders were concerned that there would be some wounded ISIS fighters, some pockets of Islamic State fighters who are still in the town. There wasn't really much of a sign of too many of them. On Friday, when the Peshmerga forces went in and really took the city, there was sporadic and heavy gunfire, but it wasn't a pitched, prolonged battle. So it didn't seem like there were many Islamic State fighters in there. One of the objectives of squeezing the city from three sides was to leave a fourth side open so that Islamic State fighters could try to escape. And then once they once they were moving out of that fourth open side, coalition airstrikes were tasked with mopping up anything that came out of that one end of the city.
Ben Kessling of the Wall Street Journal, he's speaking to us from Sinjar. Thanks and stay safe.
Thank you.
Across the border from northern Iraq in Syria, the civil war is now in its fifth year. Millions of Syrians have fled the country in search of safety elsewhere. That's been one of the biggest factors behind the massive flow of refugees into Europe. One of those who has fled is Asayed Ward. That's actually the pseudonym used by a Syrian woman from Damascus. She's spoken to us before from the Syrian capital. Now Asayed has made her way to Leicester, England, where she's attending graduate school. Today she told me she's feeling dislocated and is constantly checking the news from back home.
I woke up in the morning and I wonder, where am I exactly? And I'm following everything almost. I mean, more than when I was in Damascus, I mean, now. So because maybe I have this feeling that I have to be there in a way or another. And I keep tracking everything happening. I mean, trying to listen to everything and read what's going on. I have lots of confusion about how I feel.
You're now in the UK on a fellowship, but it sounds like you know many other Syrians who found their way to Europe as part of the recent exodus of Syrians.
Yeah, many because they were threatened, I mean, or even because they were activists, because they have a military service that they don't want to serve. I'm not supporting the regime, so I mean, I don't know many who support the regime here. But through my friends, I know that many are here, yeah, I mean, from both parties.
From the stories you've heard talking to any number of refugees, do you think some Syrians wish they hadn't made the journey?
Yeah. I mean, actually, to be honest, many of my friends, one of them was saying, I mean, to me, you know, I mean, if I have to make the decision again, maybe I'm not going to do it. I had this talk with many friends because, you know, when they just do the journey, they don't want, I mean, to tell in a way or another for those who are still in the country. And what happened? First, because they don't want to feel like they did the wrong decision. Second, they think maybe the people in the country in this condition, they won't believe them. In Syria, they were not convinced that it is that dangerous. But, I mean, you don't want to admit that you did or you just had the wrong decision or you made the wrong decision, I mean, by moving here.
I can tell from the sort of heaviness of your voice that you're really missing Damascus. And that's not a sentiment we've heard a lot from Syrians recently. What are the little things you miss about it?
Everything, maybe. For Damascus, mainly, I miss the old city. I miss just walking during the day or the night. I mean,
the old city.
And all these small roads and the lanes and just hanging out for a while. And I'm saying to myself, oh gosh, this is nostalgia symptoms. I mean, just typical nostalgia symptoms. Drinking coffee in the morning, the Turkish coffee, I just looked for coffee, for the Turkish one, here all over the place until I found it. I mean, though in Damascus, I wasn't drinking even coffee. I'm a tea person. But it was very funny. I mean, I'm saying, oh my gosh, I'm really becoming very typical. Yeah, just going abroad, doing all these small things that I thought I'm not gonna do.
So you become more Syrian now that you're abroad than you were back in Syria.
Yeah. It makes you sad sometimes because you see how horrible the situation it is. And it put lots of questions on the table for your identity, for who you are, what are you doing. But it is good. I still appreciate this.
Asayed Ward is the pseudonym for a Syrian we've talked to frequently from Damascus. She's now made her way to Leicester, England. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
What's it like being a stand-up comedian in Saudi Arabia? That's just ahead on The World.
Support for The World comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like marketing, meditation, and metalworking. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World.
Al-Fasad.
That's not our new theme music. It's a clip from a very popular YouTube show in Saudi Arabia. It's a comedy show called La Yektar. Translation? Put a lid on it. And the man behind it is Fahad Al-Butari. He's from Saudi Arabia, and he's chosen a career that's quite unusual in the kingdom. He's a stand-up comic. Buteri says he first got into comedy as a student here in the U.S.
I used to be an undergrad at UT Austin, the University of Texas at Austin. And what happened was, during pursuing a bachelor's degree in geophysics from UT Austin, I happened to basically try out a few open mic nights at the local comedy clubs there, and found out that I'm pretty good at it, and I pretty much love performing on stage. And I kind of carried that experience back home with me.
We don't think of Saudi Arabia as a place for stand-up comics, and it's hard to believe there's a lot of comedy clubs. You got your start in Austin. How did you adapt your humor for Saudi Arabia?
Well, it's pretty easy. When we started doing stand-up comedy shows back home, they were in English, the performances. So we didn't have to translate too much, and pretty much used the same kind of material that I would use in Austin, which is basically drawing from my own cultural background. Being a Saudi student in the U.S., that's a rich source of material for me personally. And what happened was, when I got back home, it just basically, I changed the source of material from being a student to being an employee.
So your audience for those English language shows in Saudi Arabia were probably educated Saudis who maybe many of them had studied overseas as well.
Oh, yeah. And probably are very well versed in stand-up comedy. So they've seen stand-up comedy performances before. So that's mainly the audience that used to attend our first shows.
And what kind of jokes did you tell?
Well, most of the jokes that I do is observational humor, basically drawing from my family background, you know, funny situations that happen between me, my dad, my mom, that kind of thing. And the reason is because it's a difference in generations that is what's funny. Like, my dad doesn't get "that's what she said" jokes, for example. So for what I would say "that's what she said," and he pure-heartedly would ask me, okay, who is she and what did she say? So that kind of clash between generations and the comedy, specifically the senses of humor between the two generations, is usually what I draw from.
What kind of things are off limits if you're doing stand-up in Saudi Arabia? It's a pretty conservative country.
Yeah. It's the red lines are pretty standard, religion, politics, direct politics at least, and explicit content. Of course, with that, working clean gives us a chance to kind of imply certain things in an intelligent manner, so as to not express anything too explicitly. And even though a lot of people think of it as limiting for a stand-up comedian not to talk about any of those things, for us it's more of a challenge, actually, to be able to draw material while still not pissing off people. Well, pissing off some people, but not everyone.
Have you ever been called to the carpet by Saudi authorities on anything you've done?
No, not the authorities. Mainly what we are careful with is the public reactions, actually. When it comes to guidelines, we do have licensed, basically, papers from the Ministry of Culture and Information. And what we do is, our work is all licensed and it is pretty official. So it's majorly public opinion that we're worried about, not the government's reaction.
Can you ever say much about, you know, the old chestnuts that we always harp on in the West, like, you know, women driving and things like that? Can you touch on that stuff in your comedy?
Well, we did. We have a hugely popular clip that we did, which was a Bob Marley cover, and the clip is called "No Woman, No Drive."
No woman, no drive.
So didn't get any flack.
That garnered. No, not really, because it was pure satire, tongue in cheek, and I got close to 13 million views right now. So it's definitely the most popular clip that we've ever produced as part of the group Tilfaz 11.
If I come to Saudi Arabia and you're doing a show, can I just freely go to your show? Are there any restrictions on who can go?
Well, if you buy a ticket, sure. But there are no restrictions. It's just that sometimes the sections are separated and by price category, and I think that's pretty much it.
Fahad Al-Buteri is a stand-up comedian from Saudi Arabia. Thanks so much, Fahad.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Fahad mentioned being careful not to say anything too explicitly. Online trolls don't have such concerns. A prominent Muslim woman in Australia can tell you about that. Susan Carland is an academic who often appears on Australian TV wearing her hijab. She's also married to a famous talk show host, Waleed Ali. Let's just say her high profile as a Muslim Australian earns Carland a lot of attention from those online haters. And that got her thinking.
Instead of just letting all this ugliness go out into the world unanswered, how could I actually push back with something good? How can I, if they're putting ugliness into the world, how could I actually put something beautiful in response to that, to sort of even things up? And just as I was sitting there, I thought, why don't I donate $1 to charity for every hate-filled tweet I get?
That's one Australian dollar for each hateful message. Carland gives the money to UNICEF, her charity of choice. She started last month and quickly reached $1,000 in donations. At this point, she's not quite sure what the total is.
I actually couldn't tell you for certain. And what I generally try to do is every time I see one, I make a mental note. And then at the end of a certain period, I try to round it up a bit just to be on the safe side. I would rather over-donate to UNICEF than undercharge and be a liar. So, I think, I don't know. It's funny because it's not just on Twitter. People have found my email, my work email, and sent me some unpleasant emails in the last couple of days too. So I don't know if I should pay extra for that because they're a lot more than 140 characters.
Carland still gets trolled, but her idea has also attracted a lot of support. She says she's even received a note from a man who donated $50 to UNICEF and told her not to worry about the next 50 hate messages. He had it covered. For Carland, all the attention is nice, but that wasn't the point.
I wasn't trying to start anything when I did this. I was honestly just me sitting at my computer thinking, what can I do? What do I think is the way to live what I believe? And so now I see that the sort of the knock-on effects of people saying, well, this is something positive and this is something that I want to take on too. And, you know, anything that puts more good and positivity out in the world and sort of disempowers hate is a good thing. And if that can happen and if that can sort of encourage other people that might be feeling miserable about the hate directed at them and have them say, actually, you know, I can take back a bit of power in this sense, and not just power but positivity, and I'm not going to let their hate mold me. I'm going to choose to be who I am. That'd be fantastic.
Australian academic Susan Carland in Melbourne. You can find her message of positivity on Twitter at Susan Carland. Still ahead, a young Muslim American was killed before he could realize his dream to provide dental care to refugees from his parents' native country, Syria. But his friends and family decided to honor his memory by making that dream a reality. That story's coming up right here on The World. I'm Carol Hills. A former international student at the University of Missouri takes a hard look at the racial divide on campus.
Those years were very happy years and years that I'm very grateful for. And so hearing about the tension on the campus right now has been really hard.
That story is ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International and by Soundworks.org, offering perspectives on events and cultures around the globe with The World's Daily Podcast and the Studio 360 Podcast. Subscribe at Soundworks.org or iTunes.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. We're going to spend the next few minutes talking about higher ed and how student protests here in the U.S. and in South Africa have pushed for big changes on their respective campuses. We begin with this update. The University of Missouri system has a new interim president. He's Michael Middleton, a veteran administrator at Mizzou, and one of the University of Missouri's first Black law school graduates. His predecessor and the university's chancellor both resigned after student protests over racial issues on campus. We wondered how this story looks from the perspective of a former foreign student at Mizzou, our friend and reporter Ritu Chatterjee. She came to the University of Missouri from India to get her master's degree in journalism.
You know, Mizzou was my introduction to the U.S. My first 4 years in the United States, I spent on that campus, the first two studying biology, and then I switched to the journalism program, which is one of the best programs in the country. And for most of my friends and I, those years were very happy years and years that I'm very grateful for. And so hearing about the tension on the campus right now has been really hard. It's been a very emotional process.
Are the kinds of things you're hearing from the protesters about the kind of racial incidents that are occurring, do they ring true to you?
You know, this is the interesting thing, because nothing like that happened to me. But then as I followed the events in Mizzou, I've come to realize that I didn't know about them because I lived in somewhat of a bubble, surrounded by very highly educated, well-traveled people. But also there wasn't the environment to talk openly about these things. And so these incidents were happening around me. I just didn't know about them. I was talking to one of my best friends who got her PhD at Mizzou, and she's Indian as well. And I asked her if she had faced anything, and she said no. But when she worked as a TA, a teaching assistant, she would interact with students, and she heard again and again from African-American students that they felt very alienated on campus, and that they had met other students, white students from the Midwest, who'd never seen a black person before. So clearly these things were happening then, and somehow we didn't know about it if we didn't face it. And that clearly didn't help in addressing the problem.
So it sort of sounds like there was a difference between your world, where other graduate students, many of them from other places, who had traveled around, and a lot of what we're hearing about seems to be going on at the undergraduate level, when you get a whole bunch of people from all parts of Missouri and elsewhere, and many of them from rural areas. That's where this seems to be going on.
Yes, but I will also add that I think it was also happening at the grad level. So just to give you an example, a story that I recently heard from a friend who works at the J School and a colleague of hers who was friends with this Eritrean graduate student at the journalism school. This particular staff member at the university was very good friends with this woman, and his entire family was very close to her. And she called them recently, and she was crying on the phone, hearing about all the incidents that have come out lately. And she said, you know, I have such good memories with you guys at Mizzou, but I face this every day. And this family was shocked to hear of all the things she said, how people would see her on the streets and walk to the other side, or just sort of daily, you know, seemingly minor incidents, but they added up, and she lived with that every day. And so this family was horrified at hearing about this and said, why didn't you tell us? And she said, you know, you were my happy memory. I had such a wonderful time when I was hanging out with you and your family that I didn't want to spoil it by bringing up bad stuff. So clearly somebody, you know, my African-American friends on campus might have been experiencing the same thing, but I never knew to ask. It just didn't occur to me to ask, and they didn't tell. But clearly these things were happening among graduate students too.
Do you think these protests will change University of Missouri?
I'm hopeful. From what I'm hearing from friends on campus, that the campus is extremely divided right now, and it breaks my heart to hear that, especially since I have such fond memories. It's not only about students who are protesting and not protesting. Even staff members who've been working alongside each other, you know, these protests have brought out their own fundamental differences in how they view this, whether they believe that racism exists or whether they don't. And so the campus is extremely polarized. But, you know, the diversity training that the university is requiring staff members and students to take now, I think that's a huge step forward. And I'm hopeful that, you know, beyond sort of the aggression that we've read about and heard about, beyond the anger, I'm hopeful that there will be a positive conversation, ongoing conversation, that brings about change and more tolerance.
Ritu Chatterjee is a friend of the show. She's a reporter who studied biology and journalism at the University of Missouri. Thanks, Ritu.
Thanks, Carol.
It's interesting to compare the student protests in Missouri and at other American campuses with what's been going on in South Africa over the past few months. University students there are protesting everything from colonial-era statues to symbols of apartheid to higher fees and corrupt government. At Stellenbosch University near Cape Town, they were pushing the administration to drop Afrikaans as the language of instruction, saying it discriminates against non-Afrikaans speakers. This week, the university administration agreed to do so. Simone Cupido of the activist group Open Simone Stellenbosch joins me from campus. Simone, this is a big deal for a campus that was really once the intellectual home of apartheid ideology.
Yes, it definitely is. We're breaking down such big barriers with this move forward currently.
Tell us how it worked at Stellenbosch. Its origins are in the Afrikaans community. Was the teaching solely in Afrikaans? Was it a combination of Afrikaans and English? How did it work?
Well, initially, it was completely an Afrikaans university. In 1994, things had to drastically change throughout the country, and then English was introduced into this institution.
But not completely? There were certain courses that were solely taught in Afrikaans?
So basically, English wasn't introduced in terms of like a language of instruction. It was basically English became accommodated for. But this is problematic because the university was getting more and more diverse students from different parts of the country. And so it became a greater need for English. And then we moved toward the plan that we currently have, which is like a 50-50 kind of negotiation with English and Afrikaans. That becomes a problem if Afrikaans is not your second, third, or even fourth language. And if Afrikaans is uncommon to you, then you end up only retaining 50% of the lecture. And when this becomes a racial issue is when you consider the fact that there are 11 national languages, and most people of color in this country speak isiXhosa, we speak Zulu, we speak Tswana, we speak all different kinds of African languages, and Afrikaans is not first or second or third for us. But English is, for a lot of people, a second language because it is actually installed in our educational program, and we learn it from the second grade.
There's so many issues going on in South Africa. Why did you decide to focus on the Afrikaans issue?
Despite the many issues going on in South Africa, we had to choose something that specifically spoke to access to education and kind of broadening the environment in which we attain education. And for us, Afrikaans was limiting for students. It was the reason for many black students dropping out of university, not coping, because they simply could not understand the language of tuition. And so for us, it was kind of like Afrikaans is a strong characteristic of apartheid and apartheid ideology. And so for us, it dominating in this space is kind of just an echoing of apartheid sentiment.
How did you persuade the administration at Stellenbosch to switch to English?
It was a long year. It was a long year of protest and fighting on every forum and research, intense research into how the institution specifically works and who the main key representatives were in positions of management and in the administration.
Are you paying any attention to the anti-racism protests happening on college campuses here in the U.S.?
Yes, very, with bated breath. And in fact, we as Open Stellenbosch, the movement, has pledged solidarity with Mizzou for a very important reason. We understand the importance of black students in education and the idea that because of segregation in the U.S. and apartheid in South Africa, the space is still unwelcoming and still needs to be broken down to include these demographics.
Simone Cupido is a student activist at Stellenbosch University in South Africa. The university plans to stop teaching in Afrikaans and switch completely to English. We have an update now on a story that we covered back in February. It got a lot of coverage around the world. It happened in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. A man barged into an apartment there and shot three students to death. Dia Baraka, Yusor Abu Salha, and Razan Abu Salha, all Muslim Americans. Prosecutors are still considering whether to pursue it as a hate crime, but this isn't an update about the case. It's a story about the dream Dia Barakat had and how his friends and family made it happen in the months after the tragedy. Jorge Valencia of Station WUNC has the story.
Dia Barakat was a tall guy with a big smile and big ideas. He wanted to help people from his parents' native country, Syria. He was 23, a dental student, and he figured people fleeing Syria would need dental care. So he started planning. Here's his dad, Nami Barakat.
I have seen him with his laundry basket where he had these, toothpaste in it and, toothbrushes. I said, Dia, what are you doing?
Dia was trying to collect $20,000. That's how much money he would need to buy supplies and to take a group of volunteers to Turkey for a week. So he stood outside of mosques in North Carolina selling toothbrush kits, $5 each. He also made a video and uploaded it to the internet.
My name is Dia Barakat. I'm a dental student at UNC, and I need your help. Have you ever felt helpless about the situation in Syria and felt like you can't do anything about it? Well, this is your opportunity to help.
By the time Dia, his wife Yusur Abu Salha, and her sister Rizan Abu Salha were killed, he had raised $16,000. Over the following month, strangers donated more than $500,000. So the friends and family of Dia, Yusur, and Rizan decided they would carry out Dia's plan. Here's his brother, Faris.
I remember moving out his stuff from the apartment, and there was like a sheet of paper there about the trip, like all the things he wanted to do. Like there was something there about educating the patients about dental hygiene. Like there's all these, like he had such a calculated and invested approach to this.
In late July, Dia's father, brother, and more than 40 American Muslim volunteers set out for Turkey. They included friends Dia encouraged to study dentistry and people from across the U.S. who'd never even met him. From Istanbul, the group flew to Hatay province. Then they drove 45 minutes to Reyhanli, a busy crossing point with Syria. Here's Faris.
Ahmed, you want to see Syria? That's the border. You see the barbed wire? That's Syria right there.
There's a small dental clinic here, just past the entrance of the Al Salam School. But across the playground, the volunteers set up a larger temporary clinic with 8 brand new dental chairs. They put up a poster with black and white drawings of Rizan, Yusur, and Dia, and the words, "The Three Winners." The first day is chaotic. Sarah Araf is a dentist who traveled from Cleveland. Faris helps her as she's treating children.
Oh my gosh. Oh, there it is. She just pulled out a little girl's tooth. How old is she? 9?
7.
Soon, Faris takes the unofficial job of child whisperer. Many of the kids are too scared to get in the chair. Faris tries to calm them by explaining in Arabic what's going to happen. Though Sarah Araf doesn't entirely agree with his approach.
Faris decided to use the word needle on a kid and he freaked him out.
I told him how it is. He was afraid of needles. I told him, bear with me on the needle.
I told him to call it sleepy juice. And I'm pretty sure...
I don't know how to translate sleepy juice into Arabic.
I'm pretty sure if you said sleepy juice, things would have gone a lot better than they did.
Well, anyways, it worked out. And I think we took his phobia for needles and fixed it.
Most of the patients here are children, and many have witnessed violence. One boy was struck with shrapnel on a cheekbone and can no longer close his right eye. Heaven, heaven, heaven. Our home is really heaven. On the fourth day, a few dozen high school students serenade the volunteers with songs about homes and Hama, cities that largely have been destroyed by the war. Faris covers his eyes. He thinks about the month since his brother's death. He quit his job managing a courier company in North Carolina. And he's helping build a Muslim community center in Raleigh named after Dia, which in Arabic means light.
I think what I'm doing through the Lighthouse Project is what I'm meant to do in a sense and what I want to do. And this is helping me explore everything that I've ever wanted to explore. You know, at the end of the day, do the work that earns me personal salvation. And that's where I'll see my brother and the prophets, all of them.
So far, Dia's project Refugee Smiles has helped more than 700 Syrian refugees, and his family says the donations will fund dental care and other refugee relief for years to come. Yet Faris says he's caught himself wishing he could give back the great things that have happened since the shooting, if it meant he could have Dia, Yusur, and Rizan back. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
Jorge reported from southern Turkey with support from the International Center for Journalists, sponsored by the Ford Foundation. Some good news for monarch butterflies. That's still ahead on The World.
The World's Global Nation education coverage is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, part of the American Graduate Let's Make It Happen initiative, supporting communities as they work to end the dropout crisis. AmericanGraduate.org.
I'm Carol Hills with The World. Monarch butterflies in North America suffered a huge decline in recent years. The number of butterflies successfully making the annual migration down to Mexico was said to have dropped by 90%. Last year, authorities in Mexico, the U.S., and Canada pledged to take urgent action to help those numbers come back up. This year, they say monarch butterfly numbers in central Mexico are up to four times higher than 12 months ago. U.S. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell made this comment yesterday while visiting a sanctuary in Mexico.
This place is beautiful. It is a testament to the people who own these lands and care for them and the natural protected areas of Mexico that you've recognized the importance of these areas for the monarch butterfly and have really been so instrumental in bringing them back to life when they came so close to being wiped out.
Pablo Jaramillo is a professor of ecology at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. Professor Jaramillo, do you agree with the optimistic comments of Secretary Jewell?
I agree partly. We cannot say for sure that the monarch numbers are going to come up. They have not finished migrating, and we do have to get surveys of the area to find out if they have actually increased or not. Monarch butterflies form their colonies throughout November, and they establish their colonies in December, so that's when we can get an actual estimate of the area covered by them, and that way we can estimate the size of their colonies and how many are there.
Yeah, this time of year, when you walk out into those protected areas of central Mexico where the monarchs are arriving, what do you see?
Well, you see a lot of them flying around. Some are early birds. They started arriving on the 3rd of November, and they continue to arrive. I was in Querétaro last week on Sunday, and I saw them on their way.
I read that last year there were over 56 million butterflies that arrived in Mexico. What about these designated butterfly corridors I hear about? I know they're being set up. Is it too early to say if they're working yet?
Definitely. And I think that any signs of recovery should be accompanied by a well-thought-out monitoring plan of the recovery areas. If it's either the corridors or prairies, and even areas in the forest that are also protected. We have to be monitoring the recovery of the areas as well as the recovery of the populations of the butterflies.
What are the biggest conservation hurdles facing the monarchs? Is it pesticides on fields in North America or deforestation in Mexico or what?
That's a great question. I think it's both. Think about a monarch butterfly that goes through the whole cycle in North America. So it's three generations in the United States and Canada, and the fourth generation comes into Mexico. And what if those forests are not well conserved? So that means that their whole migratory phenomenon is endangered because they don't have their homes for the winter. And what if when they go back to the States, they cannot find enough milkweed plants to lay their eggs on? So it has to be a very, very well thought out plan to protect them overall.
What's your favorite place to go and visit the monarchs and witness the spectacle of them returning to Mexico?
I love them all. The thing for me is that after realizing how many hurdles they have to go through to come back every year, it's just amazing to see them again year after year, and especially after so many threats that they go through. So once you get there, if you're lucky enough and it's quite sunny, they're going to be flying all over the place, and looking at them just fluttering all over. It's amazing. It's a beautiful, beautiful experience you might have. For me, it's the right description of the word awe.
Pablo Jaramillo is a conservation scientist in Mexico. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And finally, let's head south ourselves, musically at least, with a new collection of old funk and soul tracks from Brazil.
Ontem lá na praia, quando vi você passar.
The collection was put together by two record crate diggers, Greg Kaz in Queens and Jeff Swallum in Boston. It's available on CD, but also in a box set of old-style 45s. Jeff Swallum created his own record label, Cultures of Soul, to help spread the gospel of rare vinyl from the 1960s and 70s. He came into our studio to play some of his favorite tracks, starting with the one we're listening to now by Tony Tornado.
E no fim de tudo aquilo, só se ouvia a gente a gritar, puxa, chuta.
He's still kicking around now. He's in his 80s. He grew up in Brazil, actually spent about 5 years living in the States, and he's really an interesting guy. He's kind of big in life, 6.5 feet, and he's kind of controversial at the time. because it really stood up for Black Power and was given the Black Power salutes, and the Brazilian military or right-wing government really didn't like that at the time. It's very, very strict politically there. The importance of this collection really is to put it out on the 45 format. Many people think the 45 format is kind of dead, no one's ever using it again. But there really are a lot of nightclubs and a lot of DJs throughout the world that strictly play 45. So I really wanted this music, first off, to come out because it's hard to find, it's very expensive, but secondly, to come out in the 45 format so that those DJs could play it. Probably the rarest track on here is by the group 2001 in Abeto. It's a sort of mysterious production group. There isn't really much known about them, and it's one that, you know, collectors are kind of fiending to try to find, so it was great really to have it on this collection for them. It was really hard to go through and try to select these tracks, but these were kind of chosen because they're my favorites, and also there's kind of a wide range going across funk music. There's some psych tracks on here. There's also some kind of slower, spaced out, groovy tracks. So it was really just, they all fit together in this compilation. You know, they fit together as just a box set. The last track we're going to play in this compilation is Cilia Ahora Aessa, which came out in 1972.
That's Jeff Swallum of the Cultures of Soul record label. The box set of 45s, yes, 45s, is called the Brasileiro Treasure Box of Funk and Soul. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. Marco Werman is back on Monday. Have a great weekend. Que você tenha defeito, que carregue no seu peito alguma crença ou devoção. A hora é essa, perdi mocidade à beça, dando mal à tradição. Se a família chamar, diga que eu não estou. Se a família chamar, diga que eu não vou. Não tenho culpa se meu mundo é diferente. Se o amor lidera a gente, sem ter distinção de cor. A hora é essa, perdi mocidade. The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston. Brought to you by PRI's Global Reporting Fund, supporting its diverse reporting efforts, including ongoing global health coverage and its Across Women's Lives initiative. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Garrett and Cecilia Boone, the Gruber Family Foundation, Lynn and Bruce Dayton, and the Harold Simmons Foundation. The Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation working to build a world where nuclear weapons will never be used again. By the Ford Foundation, by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, including Linda Larson and Jerry Johnson, the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Noor Hall, and by the National Endowment for the Arts.
PRI, Public Radio International.